section of Ways and Means, Transportation Economic Development. The chair of this subcommittee, Greg Smith, is unable to attend today. He needs to be back in district, and so he's asked if I would convene in his behalf. And so our items today, Madam Robin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, today we are having a public hearing on Senate Bill 5517, which is the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and the presentation will be by the Labor Commissioner Dan Gardner and the Deputy Labor Commissioner Annette Talbot.
Okay. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
Our numbers are few, but we're intently interested.
I was going to say thank you, Mr. Chair and member of the committee, but but for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and if we could start through our presentation. It really starts behind the first appendix, which is the agency overview, which gets into the mission of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to promote and to develop a highly skilled and competitive workforce in Oregon through partnership with government, labor, business, and education. That's through the apprenticeship and training division of the Bureau, and to protect the rights of workers and citizens to equal and non-discriminatory treatment through the Civil Rights Division, to encourage enforcement and compliance with state law related to wage and hour terms and conditions of employment through the Wage and Hour Division, and advocate for policies that balance the demands of workplace and employers with the protection of workers and their families. And through the different divisions, we serve that particular mission. On the next page, you'll find some of the investment in priority services through the Bureau of Labor and Industries. It invests in priority services that match the governor's core principles and buys these critical services for citizens of the state of Oregon through things like the Equal Opportunity Protection and Access, offering non-discrimination protection through the Civil Rights Division, protecting for housing access and assuring workforce diversity. There's welfare through wellness for working families, ensuring opportunities to care for family and have job security through the Oregon Family Leave Act, through OFLA. Also, to safeguard injured workers, we do through contract with OSHA discrimination based upon being an injured worker. We also protect vulnerable populations such as the low-wage workers and farm workers. Education and industry-driven workforce training. We will get into the apprenticeship and training division here in a little bit, but there really is, through the apprenticeship and training division, a 5-to-1 return ratio on investment to the economy of the state of Oregon, where we train through over 150 apprenticeship and training programs, between 5 and 6,000 apprentices every single year. And, you know, it's also training for family wage jobs with increased earning levels, improving economic development, and responding to projected shortages. Income and economic security and safety for workers. We protect wages and income security through, you know, making sure that they're paid the proper wages through minimum wage, through also through things like the Wage Security Fund, where if a worker, you know, if the business goes out of business owing the worker wages, we can pay for up to $4,000 of their wages through that. We also are stabilizing security for families through the Wage Security Fund, assuring healthy working conditions. Also try to create a positive business environment through our technical assistance unit. Businesses are offered courses throughout the state. We answer over 25,000 phone calls from employers on inquiries every year, and put on those training seminars. And we also have manuals that we sell, and that's a completely other funded supported area through technical assistance. We also assist in agriculture through educational resources and labor contractors through licensing farm labor contractors. The investment clearly matches with the governor's core principles. The core principles of Oregon having a positive business climate and investing in economic development in order to create and retain sustainable businesses and family wage jobs, both through the apprenticeship division and the technical assistance unit. Oregon's most vulnerable have their basic health, food, and shelter needs met. We do that through assuring protection of minimum wage and final paychecks, illegal deductions through paychecks issues and areas like that. Adults have a lifelong opportunity to develop career skills through post-secondary education, ongoing training, and professional development through the Apprenticeship and Training Division. These investments offer protection to 1.6 million individuals in the workplace, along with their families, and services to 100,000 employers in employment law, education, and workforce development. Some of the direct services per biennium you can see listed here as well, assisting 50,000 individuals with discrimination issues through disabilities and housing concerns, providing technical assistance to over 45,000 employers, increasing skills to 10,000 managers and supervisors, responding to 60,000 workers with wage and working conditions concerns, securing and recovering over $2 million in income that was due to workers through our efforts, providing education and training to over 4,000 employers, helping educate and protect investment over 5,000 apprentices, stabilizing working families with over $2 million from the Wage Security Fund, and educating and serving 100,000-plus farm workers in the state. On the next page, it talks a little bit about, I call this kind of the balloon effect, if you will. It's kind of like every time you poke a balloon, one area comes out and another area. So some of the things that would happen without parts of our bureau being there and other benefits is we really ease the burden of the courts by having a more cost-effective administrative dispute resolution process rather than always going to court. We do that in many areas through both the Wage and Hour Division and the Civil Rights Division. We minimize costly disputes and litigation by offering technical assistance to employers to enhance compliance. That really is through the TA, the Technical Assistance Unit. Our goal is always to avoid problems before they ever occur through education to employers to make sure the problems don't happen from the very beginning. We also avoids community and family destabilization by ensuring income security through the Wage Security Fund, through the Wage and Hour Division, and through the Farm Labor Unit. We protect family values by assuring workers they receive the leave to care for themselves or a sick family member through the Oregon Family Leave Act. We also protect those who are most vulnerable by avoiding further reliance on public assistance. The next page through our organizational chart, if I could, we'll have each one of the division heads just give you a quick overview of each one of those of the technical areas. And while Amy's coming up here, if I could, I'll go through the real quickly the technical assistance tab. In your binder. Some of this we've already mentioned, you know, talking about the technical assistance and the phone calls that they answer, the seminars they put on. It's actually really the gem, one of the gems of the Bureau, in that it's completely other fund protected. It's and it is partly under the Commissioner's office. As I said earlier, we provide staff answers over 25,000 phone calls. There are over 8 publications that we put out on family leave law, policy writing guidelines, documents and discipline, wage and hour laws, civil rights, white-collar exemption, and record-keeping requirements. The program also provides the required state posters to employers, available both in English and Spanish. We also have the 7-in-1 poster to inform both employers and employees of both federal and state law. The trainers conduct 132 BOLI-sponsored seminars in 2004, serving a total of 2,252 participants. The seminars are open to employers throughout the state. And additionally, the technical assistance team also has held 106 on-site seminars for employers serving an estimated 3,600 participants. And if Amy Clare is the head of the Civil Rights Division, if she can walk you through the next tab, which is the Civil Rights Division.
Good afternoon, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amy Clare, and I'm the administrator of the Civil Rights Division. And I'm pleased to be here this afternoon. The Civil Rights Division enforces anti-discrimination laws in employment, housing, career schools, and places of public accommodation. Places of public accommodation would include, like, transportation facilities, you know, your bus service, public buildings, restaurants, other places where people congregate out in the public. These laws also ensure the workers' protection when they report worksite safety violations, when they use family leave provisions, or when they use the workers' compensation system. We've lately been trying to do more outreach. I mean, in addition to what's done by the technical assistance program, we've been trying to do outreach to what we consider our customers, which are both employers, employees, and just members of the public who want to know more about what we do and what our processes are. And then we respond, as you were told earlier, to complaints or inquiries about discrimination. Some of those may not turn into complaints. In fact, we get approximately 25 to 27,000 inquiries each year. And those inquiries usually are phone calls, but they can be walk-ins or they can be somebody that's emailed us. So we count those. And then those inquiries translate into approximately 2,100 complaints each year. Those are formal charges that are investigated by our investigators. We have a lot of vacancies, but we have 14 investigators that are taking on 2,100 complaints a year. And part of what we do when we're trying to educate the public about what we do is emphasize that we are a neutral law enforcement agency. We do not take sides in our cases. Sometimes when a respondent, which is generally an employer, gets a discrimination complaint, they think that we're going after them, but actually what we're doing is trying to find out the facts. And the reality is the vast majority of our cases are dismissed for lack of substantial evidence. Oftentimes people feel they've been treated poorly, and maybe they have, but they're not violating, you know, the employer is not violating any laws because of someone's protected class. The complainant has the burden of identifying themselves of having a protected class. Then they have to identify a harm, and then they have to at least articulate a link between that their protected class and the harm. And that is really what we call the nexus, the causal link, and that is the hardest part for them to prove. We find cause where we find substantial evidence of discrimination in fewer than 10% of our cases. Once we do find cause, then we do advocate. We try to settle the cases. We actually try to settle cases all throughout the process, but once it's gone cause, a manager, or I've actually been doing these myself, we bring both parties together and try to come up with a resolution so that they don't end up having to go to court. And we've been really successful these last several months in really bringing people in person and trying to resolve it after we've made a finding. Let's see what I've not covered.
Mr. Chair. Senator Morris.
Maybe we could just pause for just a minute for a question. Of the complaints that you receive, what percentage approximately would be driven by sexual orientation discrimination?
Okay.
Do you have data that you could share with respect to that issue?
Mr. Chair and Senator Morse, as you know, sexual orientation per se is not covered under state law. We can take some cases by association because of the Tanner decision, and I won't try to go all into that now. But we do have contracts with local entities. We have the City of Portland, Multnomah County, City of Bend, we're soon going to have one, but we have one with City of Corvallis and Benton County and the City of Salem. We get approximately, I know for both, because some of these are pretty new, but for City of Portland, they contract with us, so we can't take more than about 20 cases a year. The same thing for Multnomah County. What we've been doing now, though, if they present an intake to us and it's covered by both of their ordinances, we just take it as one claim. So there, I would say in aggregate, we get probably 80 cases, if you're including the ones we take by association. It may be fewer. It may be 20 to 50, and we can get those from our data person if you need the exact numbers.
Mr. Chair, I would not need the exact numbers. I was just wanting...
So you get an idea that if we're taking in between 2,100, it varies every year, 2,100 to 2,300 cases of alleging discrimination each year. It's a fairly small percentage.
Interesting. I have other information that was presented to me in this booklet that says 21% of the complaints are sex discrimination, 20% are disability, 15% are injured worker, and 10% were race color, which is actually a pretty significant number.
Yeah. No, Mr. Chair, the category of sex discrimination includes pregnancy disabilities, so there's a protected class for pregnancy in addition to family leave, pregnancy disability. It also includes sex harassment, and I think the majority of those are sex harassment.
Just want to make sure our record is clear. You asked a question regarding sexual orientation discrimination. And
just that one aspect. I'm sorry.
Okay. Which I think would be different, but we should just clarify it on the record from sex discrimination under the state statute. Is that correct?
That's correct. Senator, excuse me, Representative Vakian.
We're going to have to change seats, Senator Morris.
I am.
Thank you for clarifying that.
And one thing I might add, Mr. Chair, is Senator Morris, is that we do get a number of inquiries from other parts of the state for sexual orientation discrimination and do have to tell them that there is no protection under the law for that if they don't live in one of those municipalities that Amy just listed where we do through contract enforce.
Mary.
Representative Vaughan.
When you say through contract, does that mean that you agree with tell me what you mean by contract. What does that entail?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, what it means is that when the local municipality, say the city of Portland, Multnomah County, or the city of Eugene or Lane County, or the city of Bend, implements a local ordinance for protection of their local citizens, what we do is enter with them by contract where they pay us to do the investigations of violations of those ordinances for them.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Just got a few more points to make, Representative Richardson and members of the committee. We're striving to complete most of our investigations within 6 months or 180 days approximately. We have under state law a year to investigate all claims before we lose jurisdiction. Some of those contract cases I mentioned to you, there's also one with OSHA for the workplace safety violations. If there's retaliation or alleged retaliation for that, that's covered under a contract we have with OSHA. Those contract cases, we have 90 days to conclude them. We're really trying to get people answers as soon as possible. I think it benefits both parties, both the complainants and respondents, when we conclude an investigation in a timely manner. Again, in terms of the citizens that are affected, per biennium, we estimate that we're assisting over 50,000 citizens. And that includes inquiries, following up on inquiries and making the right referrals if we don't have jurisdiction, or complaints about discrimination issues. And that includes people with disabilities and from diverse minority populations and working members. And then briefly, just to tell you what our performance measures are, I think you'll get more information later on in the presentation. We're working to improve the effectiveness of our intake and investigation processes, as I had mentioned to you. We were cut back pretty drastically over the last several years, so we lost a manager that oversaw the intake and support staff unit. So now we have someone in place, and she's really working on getting good numbers with our database system and really trying to serve the public in a timely manner. And one of our other performance measures is to provide responses to 80% of inquiries on whether allegations may violate civil rights laws within 2 business days. And I feel very good about this one, and we are so far meeting and exceeding this one. The other is to conduct 40% of interviews with civil rights complainants within an average of 40 days to determine if there's a sufficient basis for a full investigation. And then we'd like to, again, as I mentioned before, try to close our cases 60% of the time within 180 days. And that concludes my brief overview of our division functions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Civil Rights Division?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to bring up Christine Hammond, who's the head of the Wage and Hour Division, which is the next tab in your booklet, to give you a brief overview of Wage and Hour.
Good afternoon, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. I'm Christy Hammond, for the record. I am the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We have seven laws that we enforce in the division. I'm going to tell you a little bit about each one. You'll see on the opening page behind the Wage and Hour Division tab that we serve approximately 6,000 employees, a biennium, who file wage claims. We respond to approximately 60,000 inquiries by employees that have questions about wage and hour laws. We collect over $2 million a biennium in unpaid wages owed to workers. We issue approximately 5,000 employment certificates annually to employers who employ minors, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a minute. Commissioner Gardner referred to the Wage Security Fund program. We paid out over $1.8 million last year to 900 employees from the Wage Security Fund and made sure they got their last paycheck. And finally, we conduct prevailing wage rate investigations, and I'll also tell you a little bit more about that program. But we recover a lot of money every year for workers employed on public works projects in the state. Our child labor program primarily consists of conducting investigations of reports of unlawful employment of minors and also the issuance of employment certificates to employers who employ minors. State law requires that every employer who employs minors under the age of 18 submit to us an application for an employment certificate, which we review and determine whether or not the employment that is proposed as lawful. Occasionally we'll have an employer submit an employment certificate to us indicating that they plan to employ the minor in some unlawful occupation, say a roofing occupation or to operate a forklift, and we contact the employer and notify them that that's prohibited under the law and try to work with them to provide employment for the minor that's not in violation of the law. So we issue about 5,000 of those employment certificates annually. We also approve special work permits for minors under the age of 14 under certain circumstances and in certain industries like the entertainment industry and agricultural industry. We have special permits for both of those. And again, we investigate information that we receive about prohibited employment for minors and make sure that the children in the state are not employed at risk to their health or safety. Our farm labor contractor program has a licensing component as well as investigations. We license approximately 250 farm and forest labor contractors annually, make sure that they have the financial means to conduct a business and employ workers, and we conduct investigations of farm labor contractor law violations and assess civil penalties and occasionally debar a contractor for particularly egregious violations of the law. This is the program where we collect unpaid wages for farm workers. We have bilingual staff who are able to speak with workers in both Spanish and Russian, in addition to English, of course, and we provide outreach to that community, the farm and forest labor community, including firefighters. And you've probably been reading in recent years how big of an industry that's become in this state. These contractors are required to be licensed by us in order to employ contract work crews to fight wildfires. And we make sure that the employees that they employ are adequately trained and paid, and the contractors are in compliance with various wage and hour and farm labor contractor laws. Our prevailing wage rate program applies to public works contracts. We conduct an annual construction industry survey each summer and determine what the prevailing wage rates are in a variety of trades and regions throughout the state, and then publish those wage rates that workers employed on public works projects are required to be paid. We investigate approximately 200 complaints of violations of the law annually, and have civil penalty authority and occasionally have to debar a contractor who has intentionally failed to comply with that law. We also conduct statewide seminars for contractors and contracting agencies to help them comply with the laws.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I just want to ask you a process question. When you said that you would debar a contractor, do you work through the contractor's board to do that, or do you have your own authority?
Chair Richardson, Representative Johnson, under both the farm, labor, and prevailing wage rate laws, we have our own authority as an administrative proceeding to debar contractors under both of those laws. We actually do cooperate with the Construction Contractors Board when we have a prevailing wage rate contractor who has been debarred or owes civil penalties, and we provide that information to CCB for appropriate action on their part.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, although I might add that in order to be debarred, it has to be a particularly egregious violation or multiple violations by the same contractor.
Thank you. That's up.
Contractors have to have intentionally violated the law in order to be debarred. That program, the prevailing wage rate program, is funded by fees paid by contractors on public works projects. And those contractors pay 0.1% of the contract price. And that's what funds our enforcement and education programs under the prevailing wage rate law. We also enforce the minimum wage, overtime, and working conditions provisions of the law. Working conditions are things such as rest and meal periods. So in addition to making sure that employees are paid no less than the state minimum wage, which is currently 7 1/4 an hour, we enforce the overtime provisions of the law and respond to complaints we receive from employees alleging that they're not receiving rest and meal periods as appropriate. A similar law is called the Wage Collection Law, and it actually has provisions other than minimum wage and overtime. It applies to workers who have an agreement with their employer for a wage rate other than minimum wage. So, for example, if my employer agrees to pay me at the rate of $15 an hour and then fails to pay me, the employee can file a wage claim with us, and we have the authority to pursue those unpaid wages under that law. We also enforce unlawful deductions and failure to pay the final paycheck under that law. We receive approximately 3,000 wage claims annually and collect over $1 million in back wages annually. The Wage Security Fund is a fund that's available to pay the last 60 days of an employee's wages when their employer goes out of business and was out and is without sufficient assets to pay the final wages of their employees. And as I indicated, last year we paid over $1.8 million to more than 900 employees. We've had that fund since about 1995, and before the fund was enacted, there was really no remedy for employees who didn't receive their final paycheck where their employer went out of business and filed bankruptcy. So this fund has provided a lot of relief for workers who otherwise would have been out their final paycheck. And finally, a smaller program in our agency is the Private Employment Agency program. Prior to 1997, we actually licensed private employment agencies. That law was repealed in 1997, but we continue to have enforcement authority over private employment agencies that charge fees to applicants for their services. There are certain requirements that those agencies are required to comply with. I think we're going to be talking about the division's goals and performance measures later in the presentation. That's my summary.
Okay. Questions? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you refresh our memory with respect to the Wage Security Fund, what happened in the last session, fund balances that were drawn down, and maybe give us an update as to where we are today?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, if I could, what happened last session was the legislature appropriated $2 million out of the Wage Security Fund, and what all there were a combination of three things. One was the legislature appropriated $2 million. One was that the it's a small set-aside of unemployment insurance, and the projected amount that we were going to get last legislative session versus what we ended up really getting was $500,000 difference. So there was a short of $500,000 there, $2 million out of the fund. And then Eastmoreland and Woodland Park hospitals came along, where two hospitals closed overnight with close to 500 employees, owing most every single one of them a month's worth of wages. There were 380 wage claims filed with the Bureau of Labor and Industries through the Wage Security Fund. And as we said, we can pay out to $4,000 maximum to each and every complainant. It really makes a difference to the employee in that, you know, they've earned the money. They can't get any unemployment insurance for it because that's not covered, you know, because they're not unemployed. They were employed. They did the work. They earned the money. They just didn't get a paycheck, and they've got house payments, car payments, et cetera, to make. So it really is a great fund in that respect. But Eastmoreland Woodland Park Hospitals cost the fund $1 million, or right at $1 million. We were actually very, very dangerously close to running out of money in the fund. Fortunately, we were able to, after a couple of years of chasing after a subsequent employer, of an employer that went out of business, we reclaimed $100,000 from that. We project right now there's just a shade over $100,000 in that fund. We only get the checks from the Employment Department on a biannual basis, but we think we're going to be just barely okay until we get that next biannual check. And as Senator Morris is well aware, one of the things that we were charged with when we came to the emergency board and explained the situation to him, thinking we may have to ask the emergency board for additional funds, was they charged us with saying, okay, how can you reclaim more of the money that you pay out from employers from any assets they may have when they when their business goes out of business? And one of the things we looked at, and Senator Morris is supporting a bill that we're doing to add us along with the employee at the top of a wage of a claim for those dollars as the, you know, the business is dissolved, so that we have equal status with that of the employee for any wages additionally due. Because even in Woodland Park and Eastmoreland hospitals, there are some people who are owed more than $4,000 per month's wages.
Thank you for sharing that.
Okay. We actually do have, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I'll have this given the committee administrator. There is a chart on the Wage Security Fund showing balances over time that gives you a little bit of perspective on that as well. And I have Steve Sims with the Apprenticeship and Training Division join me up here so he can give you a brief overview of that division.
Good afternoon, Chair Richardson, committee members.
Mr. Richardson.
Senator.
Chair Richardson. Johnson. Before Mr. Sims begins his testimony, I just would like to take this opportunity, particularly in front of Director Gardner, to thank Mr. Sims for how responsive he was when I made an inquiry on behalf of a constituent. I have rarely, if ever, had agency employee get back to me as quickly, as accurately, and as just comprehensively as you did. And I think all too often we want to complain about the folks that don't get back to us or don't deliver what we need. And your response to me was just exemplary, and I want to acknowledge it publicly.
Thank you very much, Senator Johnson. We appreciate that. We're still not having a success with respect to the underlying issue for that inquiry.
That's another story.
I may be contacting you in the near future for some assistance.
Mr. Chair? I'd just like to point out that Mr. Sims got back to me more quickly and has already resolved the issue.
He fixed yours and he didn't fix mine. We talk.
We're still working on that one.
Senator, I didn't even make the request and he approached me.
Oh, wow.
Careful, I'm only wearing shoes.
It's okay, we don't have to really go through the rest of this.
Our work is done.
We have a lot of credibility with this.
Our work is done, and thank you very much. I appreciate that. The Apprenticeship and Training Division is actually staffed to the State Apprenticeship and Training Council, a 10-member body appointed by the governor and confirmed by the State Senate. What we practice is registered apprenticeship. Apprenticeship in the dictionary parlance is simply a skilled practitioner in a craft or trade teaching someone else. Registered apprenticeship, which is a government creation, is a bit more complicated. Registered apprenticeship takes that supervised on-the-job training provided by a journey person, or in the old English, a master. It combines that with classroom training, theoretical classroom training related to the trade or occupation, all tied to a set of skill standards. The division's job and the council's job is basically to work with industry, both employer and employee groups, to develop uniform industry skill standards to make sure that a practitioner or a professional in any given trade in Eastern Oregon is the same as one in Southern Oregon, is the same as one in Portland. Once we develop those uniform industry standards, we then begin to work with either private educational facilities or local community colleges to deliver the classroom training. The division then registers the apprenticeship program, the combination of skill standards and the curriculum, and we conduct regular reviews of the programs to make sure they're administered in accordance with state and federal law. The Apprenticeship and Training Division, as of December 2004, had 5,493 registered apprentices. In for calendar year 2004, we graduated 1,103 apprentices. We provide education and training assistance to over 4,000 employees. Right now, we have 152 apprenticeship committees or programs in the state training in 44 different occupations. An important part of the job of the Apprenticeship and Training Division is ensuring that equal opportunity and access to these apprenticeship opportunities is available to all Oregonians. As of the end of 2004, minority participation rates in apprenticeship programs were just under 13%. Female participation was at 6%. Both figures are of concern to the division and to the state council. We're involved in a number of initiatives to address those figures and begin to increase them. One reason why, at least we believe why, the numbers for female participation is so low is that about 75% of our apprenticeship programs are in the building and construction trades, traditionally a male-dominated field. We really understand that the building and construction trades have traditionally used apprenticeship. They like the way it works. We feel an obligation to continue to work with them. They generate the specialty trades, the ones we work with, approximately $2 billion in payroll a year based upon 2002 figures. Overall, the construction industry, going to the residential industry, the repair industry, generates about $3.2 billion in payroll. So we feel it's very important that we have a competitive workforce, and that's where we devote our efforts. Again, the division's energies are really spent in three main areas. One is the development and the registration of industry training standards. We work with both private training organizations and the community college systems to make sure that a viable curriculum is available for the occupation that they are seeking to train in. We attempt to work with our programs to ensure that they are updating that curriculum and their on-the-job training methods to meet changes in technology. In addition to registering the programs and the apprentices into those programs, we conduct annual compliance reviews. Those compliance reviews are really divided into two parts. One is looking at the EEO component. The other is looking at the delivery of training and education. We work with the committees to make sure that regardless of whether services are delivered privately or through a community college, that it is real training, that it is quality training, that it's genuine training. We've done serious compliance now for about 7 years, and I'm happy to say that all of our programs, save for one, were in compliance during the last calendar year with respect to program operations. We still have, as I mentioned earlier, quite a way to go with EEO, but we're satisfied that the majority of our participating employers understand their obligation to offer their opportunities on a fair and objective basis. And finally, probably the most important thing that we do is offer technical assistance to employers, two apprentices, and two industries. We work with them to develop the training that meets their needs. We work with apprentices who are having problems completing their programs. A recent example of our endeavors in working with the apprentices, there was a large, and I can't remember the name of the sugar process, Amalgamated Sugar Processing in Eastern Oregon recently closed their facility. I'm assuming that there's just not as much money in extracting sugar from beets anymore. Amalgamated had employed six apprentices. Two of them were close to graduating. We worked with local employers in Eastern Oregon to try to find placements for those six apprentices. Unfortunately, we could only find placements for two, but considering that we were somewhere about 120 miles southeast of Le Grand, we didn't think we could get them all placed. But I think our job is to make sure that the best interest of the apprentices are served so that they can come out of this with a living wage job. Apprenticeships do create high-paying jobs. The average monthly placement rate for a new apprentice just starting a program, their wage, is about $2,100 per month. That wage increases gradually over time as they move through their programs. When they journey out, they do have a living wage job. We believe that the state's investment in apprenticeship is one of the best values you can get, as Commissioner Gardner just referred to. There is a 5-to-1 return on investment for every dollar that the state of Oregon spends on apprenticeship in the forms of taxes paid by the apprentices.
Mr. Chairman, I have a process question. I'm not familiar with exactly what your program does, so maybe you can help me a little here. Do you deal mostly with people who are already in employment to bring their skills up? Do you bring people into your program that are unemployed, and then after that, do you try to place them? And once you tell me that, I have one other follow-up question for you.
Certainly. All three. The programs are generated by private industry. They decide that they need to increase the quality of their training, and we work with them to develop the program. In some cases, they have people already in their company that they put into the apprenticeship program to upgrade their skills. In the vast majority of cases, the industry or the occupation is looking to train new workers. So we work with the occupation, work with the employers to do recruitment and outreach to bring them a new applicant pool. And we also work with the employment division to take people who have recently become unemployed and make them aware of apprenticeship opportunities. So we really, our job basically is to help private industry develop the program they need and then promote those opportunities.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. Mr. Sims, I have just one question. I brought this up to the Business and Consumer Affairs when they were here with their budget, and it seems to me that we have lots of jobs listed over here, and then we have people and we have high unemployment. Are we lacking the tools of how to get these people together, or do you find any problems in connecting those dots?
Senator Verger, I think the tools are out there, and we have a difficult time articulating the tools. I'm very happy that in our work with the Employment Department, they've recently developed what's called the iMatch system, which is a catalog of people who are currently unemployed. We hope, using as a pilot the ODOT OTIA 3 project, they will be recruiting to hire new people for the construction industry all over the state. We hope to use that iMatch system, which will show us people who are unemployed or underemployed, show us a catalog of their skills, look for people with good matches, and then go directly to them and tell them about the opportunities that are available to them. So I think the tools are out there. I think we just have to be smarter in putting them together to become effective.
That's excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Morris.
Excuse me. Anecdotally, the deficiency is in the skills. That's what I hear consistently from employers. It's not the shortage of people, it's the shortage of people with skills. And every employer that I talk to, I say, how is it in hiring? Can you hire the people you need? And the answer almost uniformly is no, and it's a skill issue. It's not just sheer numbers of available people. It's those that are qualified. So in terms of our training and education and skills development, workforce development, community colleges, employment, what you do, we're still not getting the job done. And I think this addresses the concern of Senator Berger, is that, you know, there just is this gap. And but I think it's driven more to the skills than anything else.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sims, you've described two times in your last comments the relationship between the apprenticeship program and private industry, that it's private industry who has come to the apprentice process because they need to upgrade their employee pool, and that this is a help to private industry. So I'm trying to figure out, with the partnership that you've described, why then the necessity to bring private industry to the apprentice program through some legislation that's now making its way through the session, if this is a program, as you described, so highly valued by private industry?
Chair Richardson, if I may, Senator Johnson, I think that private industry, and again focusing on our core business, for lack of a better term, the construction industry deals with on time, under budget today, and does not necessarily look out into the future. If we look at the number of construction industry graduates that we're averaging, over the last 3 or 4 years, we've graduated about 850 individuals per year in the building and construction trades. And then if we look at the figures generated by the employment department on retirements and growth in the state of Oregon over the next, I believe, through the year 2012. Thank you. I have those labor market figures from the employment department. In the building and construction trades, they're assuming that over the next 10 years, there will be an average of 775 new jobs in the construction industry due to growth. There will also be an average of 1,212 new job openings in the construction industries due to death, disability, and retirement each year over the next 10 years. We're turning out a little bit over 800 people a year. We're only hitting about 45% of the number of people we need to turn out. I don't think industry necessarily sees that today, because they're saying, I need to be on time, under budget today. What we're hoping with the piece of legislation that you referenced, Senate Bill 150, is at least to bring employers to the apprenticeship committees in their area, open their eyes about the possibility of training people. When they begin to see that we're not getting the people we need to train more people, they at least know that there's an avenue there for them. It's more of a policy piece to make employers aware more than anything else. But to answer your question, why we feel the need for the bill, because we simply don't know if employers are well enough versed in the workforce shortages that are upcoming. And I think to tag back onto Senator Morris's point about employers don't see the skills that they need, and I would have to agree that's one of the biggest complaints from our committees. So if we've got this workforce shortage coming and we don't have people coming out with the skills that they need, we're going to have a real problem on our hands. Senator Gardner may talk about this a little bit later. We are trying to attack this problem on one level with starting some pilot programs at some high schools. We're looking at one pilot site down in the valley and one in Portland, where at least we can take existing professional technical education programs, kind of get them to buddy up with local apprenticeship committees and develop skills in those high school students, so at least they can begin to come out and fill some of those jobs. But if the numbers that the employment department has generated hold true, we won't be able to get enough people from the high schools to fill the positions.
Hello, Senator Chang.
That's the piece that I just don't understand. I have toured a couple of the apprenticeship programs, and what I don't understand is why you don't have a line snaking out around the block of young people who may not be on a college track but want to get into a lucrative profession that would put them to work immediately. I just don't understand that piece.
Well, if I might, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we do have a number of applicants in most of the programs when they open up applications. it really is trying to attract some of the best and the brightest that are out there. Unfortunately, at least in my experience with dealing with the schools, you know, the school system pushes very, very hard toward college, college, college. And there's, as we know, there's a number of young people where they're really more geared and skilled toward work with their hands.
You're making my point. We got a lot of PhDs driving cabs.
But a lot of them don't know about the opportunities that are out there. What we're trying to do with the pilot project that Steve described that we've been working on getting off the ground and working with the Department of Education on is that, unfortunately, in school cutbacks, one of the first things that gets cut is a shop program, the VocTech. It's gone. But we've got 54 apprenticeship training centers out there, most of which are not being used during the day. Some are, but most are not. If we can take a local school district, and we're going to do this in two pilots, one in an urban area and one in a rural area, and try to get the school district to match, you know, students who would be geared toward that type of a profession and bring them into that apprenticeship and training center to really reestablish some of that VocTech in the community.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
You're making my point. I think it is such a wonderful opportunity, and I try to think back to 600 years ago when I was a high school senior, and I went
630,
to
630.
I think I was there with you both.
Yeah.
And I went to all of the programs where there were colleges recruiting. Do you all show up at those and say, here's a chance to go to work in an honorable profession very quickly, or quick compared to going through a master's degree in English literature?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we really have a very limited staff with the Apprenticeship and Training Division, which we'll get to later. We've actually had a 33% staff reduction over the last 10 years at the Bureau. So we really don't have staff to go to every single one of those. We do go to some, like the Women in the Trade Show that's put on annually that brings thousands of young women and expose them to what the trades and the crafts are all about. We do go to a few other ones. One thing that I've also been trying to work on with the Department of Education is every single teacher out there, including guidance counselors, goes through a certification process, and they have to recertify every year with so many continuing education credits. What I've been trying to do is start somewhere within the next year or so a pilot project where we put a recertification process through, where we take, particularly gearing toward guidance counselors, but it can, you know, be broader reaching than that, we actually put together a training seminar in an apprenticeship and training center. We show them the math, the science, the skills that are there. If you see a pipe rack in a larger industrial facility, you'd be amazed the geometry that's involved, the math that's involved, the science of how you get, you know, chemical flows through certain piping systems, gravel compression to make sure you've got enough, stability there for the weight of the machinery that goes on top. There's a tremendous amount of skills that go into these training programs. What I'd like to do is get to the point where we have a training accredited seminar we can put guidance counselors through to help make them our advocates for apprenticeship and training within the schools, so they can help us disseminate between those students who are more geared toward college and those that are more geared toward a profession in vocational and technical training, like an apprenticeship.
Okay. Actually, Representative Watkins is waiting, and then Senator
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right.
You beat me to the punch on when you mentioned high school apprenticeship, and then the flurry of questions. And I want to belabor it just a little bit more, because I think this is an excellent budgeting discussion as well as a policy one. And I want to ask you some questions about the budgeting side. From a couple perspectives, it's interesting to hear about pilot projects, which I'm glad you're doing, but you only have to go back 20 years, not even the prehistoric 630, when we had these apprenticeship programs in our middle schools, not just the high schools, but the middle schools, fully developed, staffed, funded programs. And I know from my discussions with community college apprenticeship programs and the union apprenticeship programs that they're now getting workers that are 23 to 28 years of age or so that are just coming out of these programs and entering the workforce as opposed to 19 years old and entering the workforce. And so I think you're hitting on a dynamic, a void that is important for us to fill. From a budgeting perspective, give me some explanation as to why it's more important for us to be setting up these types of building trades apprenticeship programs at your level, which is mostly going to target people in that older age range, then dumping that money back into the middle and high schools and start setting up the apprenticeship programs at a younger age, where hopefully we can keep some kids, like Senator Johnson mentioned, interested in what they're doing and prepared to enter life as soon as they leave high school.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, first of all, there isn't, as far as state dollars, we are oversight over all of the apprenticeship and training programs out there. There isn't other dollars, for the most part, going into apprenticeship training. There is a bit through the community college fund, but most of the apprenticeship and training programs out there, for instance, this Friday, the House Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee is actually holding a committee hearing at IBEW Local 48 out on Airport Way. That particular facility, I know a little bit about. I think I might be affiliated with it. But anyway, they have a several million dollar facility, but the dollars for that are not state dollars. There's not a single state dollar involved. They have dollars that they both put in as employers and employees to create those training facilities and create those opportunities. There isn't that much state dollars actually involved in apprenticeship and training.
Chair Richardson, if I may, Representative Avakian. You're right. The average age of a starting apprentice, last time we calculated, was in 2003, is 26 years, 4 months. They're older workers. When we talk to the people who run the actual training centers about why they're so old, they say the people coming to them simply, A, don't have the basic skills, math, reading, communication skills, don't have the work ethic, and probably most shocking, are not aware of the opportunities that are available in these industries. So I think we have to continue to maintain our adult program that gets you the journey card. What we have to do is articulate that and go to the middle schools and begin to say, you need to have this type of math so that when they get to high school, they know these kind of things. When we talk about career awareness activities that currently go on under the SIM and CAM, they need to include a fully developed module on the vocational technical trades. We can talk about this becoming more of a service and high-tech economy all that we want, but those service and high-tech people need to have buildings to work in and roads to get to. So we need to articulate what we've already got and maybe redirect some of the monies that are being spent at the elementary and secondary level so that those people can step right into those jobs as adult as apprentices when they get to be 18.
Just as a point, it's not all driven by government and the trades necessarily. I know in Southern Oregon, in one of the high schools, they have a program with local contractors where a group of high school students will build a house, and they work with tradesmen who come and assist them at each phase of constructing a house, from doing the concrete work all the way up, and then they sell the house, and it's a source of funding for their programs. Anyway, it's a way to have connection with the local trades industry and high school students. Senator Virgin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the gaps that I see, for instance, Mr. Sims, are you on a board or a commission or a committee within the education system? Instead of the department having to go to the Department of Education and try to get these connections, it seems to me that you should be a part of that dialogue and discussion in the Department of Education. I see that a lot, where we don't have any voice within the decision-making or just the information that you have. You know what people are going to need, and they need to know that, not so much when it gets to the middle school, but in the decision-making of the Department of Education. Am I making it clear?
Chair Richardson, Senator Verger, without offending my friends at the Department of Education and the Office of Community Colleges that we work with very closely, and we do have some good relationships that we try to exploit. For some reason, we can't get to that policy level where we can say that these things need to happen. And I don't think it's by any ill will or ill intent. We just haven't gotten the full realization that, yes, this is a valuable part of our workforce, that we need to develop it. You need to make these program adjustments. We're talking, but we're not at, as you say, a board or a policy-making point. We're not quite there yet. Hopefully, we'll get there.
I hope so, too.
Well, committee members, we have a certain sense of the kind of work you're doing, and you certainly know how interested we are. We have a half an hour. Let's see. We have an hour left, and I want to just make sure that we're going to have plenty of time for performance measures and agency priorities. So.
Okay.
We didn't know, however, Mr. Chair, that they were going to torpedo the Department of Education, so I appreciate the fresh and frankness.
We'd just be happy for the interest off of the money you give, Mario.
Yeah.
Anyway, Mr. Chair.
I think that was an offer, Senator.
You get that started.
I'm just kidding.
A lot of interest in that money, that's for sure.
Okay. Actually, Mr. Chair, if we turn to agency overview, page 6 under your first tab, we go back to the purpose and mission over the 100-year history of the Bureau. I'm not going to, you know, go through all of the particulars in this particular section, but these sections do show you in 2003, there was our 100-year anniversary, and it really does articulate through here at different times what laws have been passed in recent years, like the Wage Security Fund in 1985, parental leave laws in 87, pregnancy and disability leave in 89. In 91, the Oregon Family Leave Law was enacted. 93, adding federal family and medical leave. And then in 95, the total consolidation, as well as the prevailing wage law amended so that we took surveys and like. The one thing I will point out in this particular section is that very few, if any, of those changes came with additional staff or additional dollars to the agency. Matter of fact, not much other than the prevailing wage fund or the wage security fund. It also continues on in the next page, talking about private employment agencies. There is one thing, since you seem to be a bit interested in apprenticeship, in 97 there was a radical change in the view on apprenticeship. Prior to 1997, apprenticeship and training programs actually were considered part of state agencies, and the Bureau did, if a program was failing, would apply staff. We also had all the programs available for Attorney General's opinion and the like, because they had state agency status as joint apprenticeship and training councils across the state. It was at that time that Commissioner Roberts decided that apprenticeship and training programs should rise or fall on their own merit, and that those who have an apprenticeship and training council need to put the time, energy, and commitment into apprenticeship and training, and not the agency itself putting in those commitments. And actually, as a freshman legislator back then, I actually very much supported and agreed with Commissioner Roberts, and that started an era with Apprenticeship and Training Division of compliance to see that all the committees complied. And now we've moved more into an era of trying some other pilot programs, because compliance, we've gotten all the committees to the point, save, as Steve reported a few minutes ago, save one program in compliance, and they're very close. So we're moving more toward the other direction we were talking about. It talks about the workers' injury fund and some other issues there. If you turn to the next page, that does talk about some of our strategic goals that we're pursuing in this biennium, including trying to get our laws substantially equivalent with the federal government for housing discrimination. The agency did some years ago do enforcement on housing discrimination through contract with the federal government. At that point in time, the reimbursement rate was not all that great, and the agency got out of the business of doing that. The reimbursement rate has now changed, and we're looking at getting substantially equivalent, so we have the opportunity for that. There are a number of other issues on that particular page there. On the next page, it does talk about the 10 principles that I used in prioritizing some of the different programs, supporting some of the key benchmarks and contributing to the governor's and the legislature's economic development efforts, minimizing and offsetting adverse impacts of the recession on worker safety and wages, avoiding worker reliance on public assistance, and a number of others. Those are kind of the guiding principles that we got to when we got to the prioritization. On the next page, we get into some of the environmental factors. Some of the things to remember about the Bureau of Labor and Industries is both on the easel there as well as on the chart in your book is that during growing economic times during the 90s, as many agencies were growing, we were completely the opposite. We actually have been reduced over 33% or by 52.78 FTE over the last 10 years. We were at 159 employees in the 93-95 biennium. We are now at 106.2. At the same time, one of the things to remember is that the workforce has dramatically increased. There's over 247,000 more Oregonians working today than there was a decade ago, which actually adds to the caseload. On the next page of talking about some of the environmental factors, you get a breakdown in the chart by division showing the Civil Rights Division, for instance, was at a high in 1995-97 of 39.5 FTE. It's now at 30. The Wage and Hour Division at 93-95 was at a high of 47.76, and it's now at 30.6. The Apprenticeship and Training Division in 93-95 was at a high of 45.5. It is now at 17.1 FTE. So it really does show a bit about how the agency has been stressed and how we have, reduced staff dramatically, or as I prefer to put it, we have given it the office. But some of the ongoing efficiencies of environmental factors. One of the things that I did over this last biennium that actually the governor accepted in his reduction package, we were able to make some consolidations within the agency. For instance, in our Portland office, we had all of the 10th floor except for a small governor's space there. And a quarter of the 11th floor. I noticed there was four different reception areas, one for each one of the divisions, as well as the commissioner's office. And what we were able to do was the governor was willing to give up his particular space. We then consolidated from four reception areas into one, and we moved everybody from the 11th floor down to the 10th floor, saving about $10,000 a month in rent. We also turned back 23 different cars into the vehicle, or 23% of the vehicle fleet, I should say, including the commissioner's car. We streamlined some of the operations both in Salem and Medford. In Medford, we went from actually having our own standalone office to having four cubicles within the employment department's offices in Medford so that we greatly reduced our overhead there as well.
I have a question. By the way, we commend you for those actions that work toward greater efficiency and use of the revenues that you have. I'm looking on the chart on page 12, and it says that between 95-97, you went from 39.88 in the apprenticeship and training column to down to 24.21, and then there's a footnote that says decline to continue Job Corps contract 11 FTEs. Did the Job Corps contract get relet to someone else, or did, you know, where do we stand? Is there a Job Corps program presently available from the federal government?
Mr. Chair, Steve can probably answer the question better than I, but my recollection is there is, and it was the commissioner at the time's decision not to re-up that contract.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Gardner is correct. At the time, Oregon was the only state where the Job Corps recruitment and placement function was handled by a state agency. Nationwide, they were all being done by private contractors. Commissioner Roberts at the time decided that it was no longer the most efficient use of government dollars to maintain a program that had essentially been let public everywhere else, so we eliminated those positions.
And so is that currently going on? I mean, I'm not really familiar with Job Corps.
They just changed the contractor for the past 6 years. It had been operated under private contract by Manpower, Inc. I'm not sure who's operating it now, but I know that they have three recruitment centers throughout the state.
Do they provide apprenticeship training as a part of that, do you know?
They don't provide apprenticeship training, and they never have. What those recruitment and placement centers were responsible for, two functions: working with youth at risk to recruit them into Job Corps training centers, and then, and this is where they made their money under the contract, actually placing them in some type of an employment opportunity. All of the Job Corps centers themselves do pre-apprenticeship training, so we still work with the Job Corps Placement Center to attempt to place those people into our program, but they themselves have never done any apprenticeship training, the contractors who held the recruitment and placement contracts.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I was outlining some of these reductions we made, those steps did contribute to $242,000 in general fund savings for expenditures in 2005-2007. I really looked at it kind of as right-sizing the agency, as well as along the way trying to improve customer service. We were able to do a number of customer service improvements as well, doing things such as actually trying to have receptionists really answer the phone and not go into answering machine mode as well. If you dial the main number, even at the Portland office, and press 0, you can get a live body on the phone to answer your questions. And also, some of the other efficiencies we made with staff was making sure that they're more customer service oriented, because I believe government is customer service. And every single employee at the Bureau is instructed every day to change their own answering machine message. So if someone's calling in to try and get a hold of that particular person, they'll know whether they're in town, out of town, in meetings, when they'll be available, so that we can be much more customer service oriented. So we've actually been able to right size as well as do some customer service improvements. You want to go on with the performance measures and goals?
Mr. Chair and committee members, pull this up. My name is Annette Talbot. I'm Deputy Labor Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I'll be going over the performance measures with you. When Commissioner Gardner took over in 2003 and we began to look at performance measures, as I started then as well, we realized that the agency's performance measures were in need of what we called a major tune-up. They needed to be revised and refocused. And so at that time, in working with the Ways and Means Subcommittee and with LFO and DAS, we asked for a budget note to be able to revise those, as we were new and had only been in working in the agency for about a month at that time. It seemed difficult during session in 2003 to actually revise them. So we spent time after session ended, and we're pleased to have our new performance measures unanimously approved in August of 2004, just a few months ago, by the Joint Legislative Audits Committee. So we do think that we've been able to revise them and refocus them on our core activities, and also to make them more realistic given the staff reductions that you've seen in our graphs here today. In doing that, we had three goals the commissioner directed us to work on, and that was focusing them on workforce and economic development, on income security, and equal opportunity. There are no specific benchmarks related to those broad topics, so we had to address basically our own performance measures in regards to that, although we do have one additional benchmark that we were able to link to on economic development that I'll speak to. Out of the 16 measures that we had when we arrived, we changed 75% of them, either adding new ones or modifying them. And again, our goal was to make sure that the measures really focused on what's important to the public and to the citizens that we were serving. So we spoke a lot with working with our division administrators who had been in the agency prior to the commissioner and I arriving, and looked at what was really doable, what was most important to citizens in terms of service, and then looking at the integrity of the process and making sure we didn't set unrealistic goals that really defeated the staff morale in getting to achieve the goals. But we did ask everyone to look at making stretch goals. In light of the reductions, a stretch goal was sometimes just maintaining somewhere around where we had set a goal before, but we also strove to achieve more where that was possible given the existing staff level. So we're pleased to report that out of the 15 measures we now have, and we have one developmental one that I'll speak to at the end relating to customer service, we have been able to achieve are expected to achieve at the end of our first full year of operating under these measures, 11 out of those 15. So we have a little bit of work to do, but I think we feel very good that for the most part we are working to achieve the goals that we've set. In that said, I'll go speak to you about the ones that we did revise. The one specifically that we revised dealing with workforce development was one related to the first benchmark, which some of you are familiar with, which is the number of Oregonians who are employed outside the Willamette Valley. In talking as the former governor's workforce policy coordinator, I was very intrigued by your workforce conversations before. We know that many workers and job applicants and are frustrated by the fact they have to leave their homes in rural Oregon in order to get trained or to find a job. So the commissioner's instruction to us was, how can we diversify the number of employers who are in rural areas outside the valley and get them attracted to apprenticeship as a training model so that people who grew up in their community could stay in their community and get trained in their community and get a job in their community.
In line with what you're saying, I'm wondering if we could receive a kind of a layout showing the number of apprenticeship programs that you have as far as statewide, you know, what, and then the number of enrollees that you have. Do you do it by district or by county? You know, but so that we can see that, and then the number that actually are graduating, so that we can see what the distribution is across the state. Could that be provided?
Mr. Chair, we will work to do the distribution. I'm not sure how detailed we can get that, but I do know that we do know the county and of all the committees that they work in and the employers that participate. So we'll try to crosswalk that between the employers and the apprentices for you.
Okay, you threw me off when you said I'm not sure if we can get that. That seems like that would be fairly standard information that you'd have.
I'm being told that we can do what you've asked.
Thank you very much.
So we have been able to meet and actually exceed our goal in recruiting more employers to participate outside the valley in an apprenticeship program. So that's we're pleased to see that. In the five measures that we have in the apprenticeship division and workforce area, we've actually met or exceeded our performance on four out of the five, and we expect to meet the one relating to the number of women that participate in apprenticeship goals this spring, because that is the most active hiring session for apprentices is in the spring when construction restarts. So we're pleased that while some of our goals were modest, that we have met or exceeded those and expect to meet the fifth one as well. as you were discussing earlier, one of the things we are trying to do is to figure out how to increase the number of people who participate in apprenticeship programs. As the economy improves, that gets a little bit easier because we always see a dip when there's a recession in terms of the number of apprentices that we're able to put on because of the lack of work. But we also are working collaboratively with our workforce partners, including the Employment Department and the community colleges, to work on making sure we have adequate numbers of apprentices to participate in the OTIA 3 transportation project. So that's going to be, I think, a good pilot project for us to look at how do we attract more individuals to apprenticeship, because we have quite a few projects across the state, again, to be able to use as a pilot program to be better partners with each other in that recruitment. Employment Department as well is working with us on getting those individuals who have the right skill sets to the contractors who are looking for them so that they can start in an apprenticeship program. So I do believe that we are working on that. We also, as Mr. Sims said, realize that we have a projected construction shortage, and I liken it to the healthcare shortage, where sometimes businesses are just operating and they don't have the opportunity to project out 10, 12 years ahead of what they're going to need. But because apprenticeship is a pipeline, you can't start today and hire people and have them train tomorrow. You have to start 4 or 5 years out at least, because that's the length of most apprenticeship programs. So that pipeline piece is important for us, and the OTIA 3 project, which is an 8 to 10-year project, is a really good opportunity for us to match those skills. So I think we are beginning to do what several of you have suggested we need to do better at. So we'll see as the test of time, I think, as those projects roll out. We have two measures for our technical assistance unit for employers, and the commissioner's already spoken about the unit, which I manage. I think it is one of the gems that state government should be very proud of. It doesn't receive general fund dollars. It is other funded by the books, and the have examples of them, so I'm very proud of them. We've put out 3 new books in December and have one on my desk and several more coming out this year that we do sell to employers to make sure that they know what the law is and that they can avoid a costly enforcement actions, which cost them money and cost us money. So we just assume people know the law up front. And that technical assistance unit has 2 performance measures, and they've exceeded both of them. And they address the issue of returning calls within a timely manner, and also in terms of getting a particular performance score when they do a seminar. We ask for ratings from every participant, and we had hoped to get a 95% with 4 or better out of a 5-point scale rating, and we've actually exceeded that and gotten 90% who give us 4.5% on a scale. So we feel very pleased about that. We set a high target, and we've met them both, despite losing actually one of our veteran employees in that unit. In terms of income security for working families, which is another issue that have performance measures on, we've had a little bit of a struggle on these, and we would have identified for the committee why we think that is. Some of them, I think, are reflective only because we had a very short time since August to actually measure them. So I hope that we can improve on them where we are having trouble. But as you can see, they've had a significant reduction in FTE in that division. And they've had no diminishing level of responsibilities. So that always makes for a challenge, as an administrator of that division will tell you. In addition, we had great deal of turnover in the staff. We had our whole prevailing wage staff turnover since 2003 when this commissioner and I started. We've lost 4 professional investigators, and we've had a manager retire and have to retrain them. And at the same time seen a significant increase in those wage security fund claims that we spoke about previously. So we are in a position.
On that, as we've referred several times to the reduction in FTEs, mm-hmm. Are there retired staff members who have been rehired and are working in a temporary position?
Mr. Chair, in the wage and hour division, we do not have any current retirees at the moment. We did have one for a brief period of time help us, but we don't have retirees in that division actually who are available. We have hired some temporary staff to help us in the prevailing wage rate area, and we will speak to that at a future time. We have policy packages relating to other fund positions that we would like the committee to consider in relating to improving our performance in prevailing wage and getting those claims processed more quickly. We do not have any attempts in wage and hour at the moment. Okay. Retirees, excuse me. I will get into the specifics of the performance problems that we have, but I will note that we are looking to improve our performance in the latter half of this year. But if we aren't able to, we will clearly have to be looking at declining to take certain types of wage claims in order to really prioritize and timely process the most important wage claims, which to us are really the minimum wage worker, the lowest income worker, and those who aren't receiving overtime for the time they've worked. So we hope to not have to be in that position, but we do believe that it's not our timeliness issue continues to be a concern for us, and if people are waiting for wages that they're due for a very long time, it diminishes, I think, their expectation of the service we should provide to them. In terms of equal opportunity, we have three measures, and we are on track to meet all of those. The expectation for these measures is a customer service-driven one. If you ever have gotten a call, and I know Representative Avakian, I'm sure has, from someone who's recently been fired and who has an employment law issue, and they want an answer pretty much right away. Do they have something that has happened to them that's unlawful, and if so, what do they do next? And so our goal is to, as efficiently as possible, return all of the calls that we get and inquiries so that we can give them at least a sense, has something happened to them that may be unlawful that we can investigate later? Clearly, we get a lot of calls where people have had issues that they believe that their employer has been unfair to them, but a lot of them, when you look right down to the facts, they're not unlawful. So we do have to work through all of those inquiries we get from employees. But our goal, again, is to get them in the system if they do have a claim, refer them somewhere else if they don't have a claim, that we can handle them for them. So you'll see specifically on those. On the next pages, we've gone over specifically what the overall goals of each division is, and sometimes the goals we have are not easily measured directly by the performance measure, so we have tried. So we've shown you on page 18, for instance, the goals of the division and then the measures that we believe are as close as we can get to seeing if we've met our overall goals. On the first measure we had, which was the 80% inquiries within 1 to 2 business days for civil rights, from July through December, we've been able to respond to 85.6% of the calls within 1 to 2 business days. We hope to be able to continue that, and we have a 2007 measure that's actually 85%. We hope to meet that, but again, with staffing reductions, this is a stretch goal for us. If we can continue to meet this, we'll be very happy. We've had, unfortunately, some turnover again in our staff this fall, and that always makes it difficult because you're continuing to have to train staff. In regards to our interviews and how quickly we're doing those, we are also exceeding our goal on that. And if you want to look at the actual chart with the data, it's on page 23. So I'm not sure, for those of you who are visual and want to see the chart, that's where to go if you're looking for that. In terms of our interviews, again, we have been able to complete. We had a goal of 40%. We've actually been able to complete 61.25% of those initial interviews within 40 days in the calendar year of 2004. And in that one, we gave you the full calendar year to reflect a longer period of time because we did have the data for that. Again, in attempting to complete our investigations, we are just quite there. Our target was 60%, and we were at 59.91%. So we're, I'd say that's close to meeting that goal. It's about as close as you can get. Again, as a former employment attorney, I can tell you that the faster that you can complete these kinds of investigation, the less tension and disruption in the workplace. So we know that that speediness is important, although quality clearly of the investigation is important. And when we've been working, and Division Administrator Ms. Clara has been working to improve the quality of our investigations as well by additional training. In the wage and hour division, which is where we've had some struggles, we had a goal of resolving our minimum wage claims within 45 days and resolving 80% of them. Unfortunately, we have not been able to meet that, again, because we're trying to continue to process all wage claims and not just minimum wage claims. And so we are in need of improvement there. We have a 45%, close to 46% goal or actual achievement. That's only for two quarters, and again, with staff turnover that we've described, we hope to try and improve at that that number of claims processing and make them happen more quickly. With the wage security claims, we actually, given the workload and wage security and the increase that you've already heard about with the number of claims we've had, I think we've done well even though we haven't met our goal. We've been able to process 63.5% of them within 30 days. Our goal was 75%. But with those large number of claims that came in one bulk from the hospital, you know that that always is difficult for staff to process. With prevailing wage rate claims, we see that we are, again, somewhat close to the goal. We're at 41.3%. Our goal was 50%. And we do have packages that you'll be looking at later to look at staff to improve the performance there. But we have been able to improve the amount of collection that we received. Actually, in those first two quarters, we collected 46% more wages in that one quarter, even though we weren't able to quite do them as quickly as we would like. In the migrant and seasonal farm worker claims, our goal was to do them in 30 days, and we revised this measure to specifically relate only to migrant and seasonal farm workers claims. We only have 5 claims within that period for that, so the result of 20% completion is a little bit misrepresentative because we had one claim that took quite a long time, so it looks like you haven't really met your goal. In essence, it really is a creature of we only had 5 claims in that category at that time. For apprenticeship and training, as I said, we did link to a benchmark, which is employment outside the Willamette Valley, and we have exceeded that. The number of apprentices receiving journey level certificates, and that is very important for us because once you've received your certificate, it's like your graduation from college, so to speak. You've got your degree, you can go out and work now and have that career in those particular trades or occupation. So that one to us is a very important indicator because it's not just a process piece, someone in the program they've actually completed. In regards to newly registering apprentices, we have also exceeded that goal in terms of the number of people we've been able to register as apprentices with our employer and employee and union partners. Our apprenticeship figure for females is a little bit low, but like I say, we expect in the spring that we will be able to increase that. And in terms of the targets outside the Willamette Valley, we've actually almost exceeded by 50% the number of targeted training agents that we've actually been able to register. In terms of the technical assistance program, I've already told you that we exceeded both of our expectations on that. And then we have a hearings division that helps hear the cases where we find cause that the employer has violated the law. And on that one, our performance measure deals with the number of orders that we have administratively upheld on appeal. And we have been able to have our goal met there as well. Our developmental performance measure is one related to customer service. And as the commissioner mentioned, when he first started, one of the things we did was go around and train all of our staff on our new policies that we had developed. And we have a customer service policy. that works to make sure that our staff know how much the commissioner emphasizes that and also addresses the voicemail that he talked about, is trying to make sure you know whether you're going to get a call back by listening to the person's voicemail. The Progress Board, as you may know, has been working on a customer service satisfaction survey, and not wanting to get out in front of them and develop our own that would maybe conflict with theirs, we have been waiting for theirs to be approved. So as soon as their board approves the survey they've developed, which I understand is already done, it just needs to be approved by their board, we will start to implement that as well. And we have set relatively high goals for that in the 70 to 80% range, and we hope to be able to meet those as well.
Questions? Okay. Mr. Chair, that brings us to the budget overview section of the budget. As you can see, the chart on page one of the budget overview compares the 2001-2003 actuals to the legislative adopted budget for 03-05. To the agency's request and the governor's recommended budget chart. We have talked about most of the information within there. There are some other charts that come on some of the adjoining pages showing about some of the operation budgets, different fund types, how much is each one of the program areas in pie chart form. Actually, we could go to the program priority worksheet. We actually do have back a little ways behind there the program priority worksheet done in the format that was requested. This is kind of an expanded format that we developed showing you know, the priority, where it, what division it was in, how the program unit and activity description, some of the performance measures and outcomes, the evidence of return and cost benefit, and number of citizens within the state that are affected. I have to tell you, it's one of the most difficult exercises I've ever been through to actually take the different programs and set them in a priority order. It's kind of like, what would you like me to cut off, my left arm or my right? But it's, you know, I think everything that we do is a priority. But, you know, we clearly set the apprenticeship and training division for its workforce and development, its 5-to-1 return ratio on investment, and a lot of the other issues we've already discussed as the highest priority. And as you can see, different list goes on from there as far as the wage and hour minimum wage claims, because those affect the poorest or the lowest paid workers across the state, and you know, we secure and recover $2 million a year through different funds, partly through the minimum wage fund for those workers across the state. It goes on to the civil rights and protected class and Oregon Family Leave Act investigations, ensuring that Oregon families have leave to take care of sick children and leave to take care of themselves, an ailing spouse or parent. We also, the next one comes along to the wage and hour and farm forest labor unit. We conduct their investigations and license 250 farm forest labor contractors, and it protects and educates under this statute approximately 100,000 farm workers a year. Then, of course, it goes on to the commissioner's office staff and the Civil Rights Division injured workers investigation. The hearings unit, we haven't really talked much about the hearings unit. That we do have a final order process through the commissioner's office where you can choose to go through our administrative process where we have an administrative law judge. We actually have two across the state that hold hearings and send recommended final orders to the commissioner, where I end up being the final arbiter in that particular process. We do a number of those types of hearings every year, and I believe it's 31 hearings each fiscal year, and settle approximately 36 cases prior to going to hearing. And that's a service that's available to all Oregonians, which is much less costly an administrative process than going through the courts, for instance. Next on the priority list was the wage and hour prevailing wage rate enforcement and education of, where we actually collect $1.7 million in unpaid prevailing wage rate wages to Oregon workers in 0103. That division conducts 182 investigations during 0305 and conducted 48 prevailing wage rate education seminars. Next, we have the technical assistance for employers, which we've talked about quite a bit, and the work that they do. And we go on to some of the contracts. We do equal employment opportunity investigations we do through the federal government.
May I ask just for a moment?
Sure.
I'll take you back to department. It's the middle of page 11. It's 8. Department 8, resolved prevailing wage claims quickly. Agency collected over $1.7 million. And then I'm looking at just crossing over to page 15, where we have that same entry and the cost for it. It says that 10 positions and the cost to do that is $1.8 million. I assume that there must be much that you do that doesn't just focus on collecting unpaid wages, or am I right that it costs more to conduct what you're doing if it's the primary purpose is to collect the wages than what we're actually getting for the people?
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, you have to understand a couple things about the prevailing wage fund. One is that that's another fund. We actually, on every public works project across the state, there's I believe it's 0.03% set aside up to a cap of $5,000 that goes into that fund. Part of what we did last legislative session was to try to attribute some real costs to the actual fund that they are overseeing. For instance, prior to last legislative session, none of Annette's time, my time, or Christy Hammond's time would have been attributed to the prevailing wage fund. Now, as of the last legislative adopted budget, 10% of my time, as well as 10% of Annette's and Christie's, as well as others throughout the agency, we conduct a number of investigations. Not all are found to have violations, and not all have recovery of actual funds for workers. So it does take a bit to do that.
Okay, thank you.
I wanted to clarify, Mr. Chair, what's referenced in your cost under number 8 is not the cost of collections, but the cost of investigation, which may or may not result in collections.
It's a total cost
right.
for that
right.
process.
Actually, we go on with the other parts of the prioritization, from the wage and hour discretionary claims to the wage and hour wage security fund, administrative support of programs for the commissioner's office. As I said before, through occupational safety and health investigations, we do contracts for them, as well as contracted investigations for local jurisdictions that we talked about earlier, and wage and hour private employment agencies, the licensing that we do there. That actually shows our priority list, which gets us to the legislature's request for us to make a recommendation of an additional 10% reduction package. As we've said before, over the last 10 years, we have had a 33% reduction in staff while having increased caseload, work rate, and increase of 247,000 more workers in the state of Oregon. It really was, you know, a difficult thing to look at that 10% reduction, but because of our reduction in staff over the last 10 years, there was no more thinning of the soup, if you will. It really came down to a question of we either need to look at elimination of programs as part of that reduction. And for that reason, and looking at our priority list, we looked at the farm labor unit for one of the reductions. That unit covers the entire state for farm labor. It provides a number of assistance through the wage and hour division, also license farm forest employers. One anecdotal bit of evidence is that for forest firefighters, which we oversee the training for through that division, over 90% of the forest firefighters for the entire country are trained either in Oregon and Washington, Oregon having more a much larger share of that 90% than the state of Washington. And so, as I'm sure you've seen in the newspapers the last several years, there is a deep need for continued oversight of that as well. It really would be an adverse impact to a highly vulnerable community of farm workers across the state. We can assure that we provide adequate workforce and agriculture industry and assist in protecting the state's forests and communities and workers from forest fires. And protect the working conditions of those most vulnerable workers. The second part of our 10% reduction package, I looked at our history chart that we went through a little while earlier showing some of the changes in law over the last several years, and one of the things that was, if you will, a mandate from the legislature was the Oregon Family Leave Act. However, no additional staff nor additional dollars came with the enforcement of the Oregon Family Leave Act. There is a few other civil rights administrative investigators in part of that package as well. The Oregon Family Leave Act, if it were to go away or investigations on it were, we would still have the Federal Leave Act. However, there are some major significant differences to take into consideration as far as the policy discussion. The Federal Act takes place at 50 or more employees. The State Act takes off at 25 or more employees. The State of Oregon also guarantees the exact same job back to an employee that that the Federal Act does not, as well as the State Act gives time off under OFLA for taking care of a sick child at home, which the Federal Act doesn't as well. That would leave basically 140,000 Oregon families without any family leave protection simply from going from 25 or more employees to 50 or more employees. So it's a significant policy question for the legislature. The third piece to the reduction packages is should the other two reductions take place, it would make sense to have a small reduction in information services staff and other service and supply reductions, making up the third part of the reduction. I actually would bring your attention to the chart over here to my right, which really talks about the state of Oregon in total, as far as the total funds, 100% of the budget being $11.49 billion. When you get down to the bottom, The cost for BOLI in 03-05 was 10.9 or 0.095% of the budget, less than 0.1%, for which we provide an awful lot of protection across the state. There are a couple of other handouts within your packet I draw your attention to that probably should be put with the appendix toward the back. Some of them show, for instance, on Appendix 4 shows other funds that the Bureau does bring in, like in, for instance, under the private employment agencies, we brought in $29,719 in the 04, calendar year 04, or from 2000 to 2004, $236,601. There's also through child labor money that went to the Common School Fund over a four-year period, $114,486. And in the farm labor camp area, where we find an unlicensed farm labor camp, the fines and penalties for that go into the State Housing Trust Fund for building of new migrant worker housing, which over a four-year period, we put $342,893 in there as well, which that one would, with the farm labor unit, go away. And some of the other handouts and comparisons within your packet, there, there is also a copy of the sheet we have on the easel over there showing the percentage of the actual budget and the value for the dollar, and there's also some sheets on estimated ending cash balances in some of the various funds as well. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions, Mr. Chairman? Representative Pavakian.
I was trying to flip through the pages and follow you. When you were talking at the end there about ending balance amounts, were you looking at the sheet entitled 2003-05 Estimated Cash Balances?
Yes, that's appendix number one in the bottom right-hand corner, yes.
And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit more about how you construe your ending balance, whether or not you just through great efficiencies have been able to create, in essence, a rainy day fund where the legislature has not, in order to help you when times are not good, or whether that money represents something different from what I just described.
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, we wouldn't be allowed to keep our own rainy day fund.
Balances.
Okay. No, actually what this is dedicated different funds. Like, for instance, the ones, probably the best place you could look at is to the far right on some of these, like the second one down showing the CRD, that's the Civil Rights Division, City of Contracts. That's the money that comes in for those ordinances that we oversee. You'll also see money coming in from the injured workers. That would be from OSHA by contract for what we do by contract for investigating for retaliation on being an injured worker. You want to explain the differences between your two here?
I'd be happy to. Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, my name is Janie Bailey, and I'm the budget officer for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'll try and go through this chart with you. The purpose of the chart was to identify what our beginning cash balances were, to include revenues, actual revenues and actual expenditures through January 2005, and then our estimated revenues and expenditures for the balance of the biennium, and give you some kind of a projection of where we think we're going to be at the end of June. And in each case, we've tried to talk a little bit under the comments and complete description along with any statutory authority related to those dollars, what the ending cash balance is made up of or why there is one. In many cases, it provides us with operational funds until we receive the next payments, either from contracts that we have in place with other state agencies or other government agencies, and or it provides us funding to operate the program until we get large influxes of cash, like from the Wage Security Fund, which only comes to us once in every biennium, and it comes to us in the eighth quarter. If you have specific questions on any one of these, I'd be happy to answer them.
No, I think you answered my questions.
Thank you.
And I promised her she wouldn't have to testify.
Oh, very well. Let's just look over his hand up for a minute. Other questions for today? Nothing? Do you have anything?
No, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say that I believe that this wraps up their presentation. Unless there are additional questions from the subcommittee, which means that we will not have any presentation tomorrow.
Sure.
Mr. Right. Chair, we're happy to wrap up a day in 5 minutes early.
Hey, that works out great. There is that one request that we'd like.
No,
to
No, we will. Sometimes. We will get that to you.
Well, without further questions, then we will dismiss. Thank you very much for your time and effort for inviting this to us.
Thank you.